Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up tonight on 1A Plus, it's your weekly roundup from Jen White, which includes a banking collapse, an oil drilling deal, and the latest on a Texas court case that could upend access to reproductive health care nationwide. That's tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, whether you're laughing to avoid an awkward situation or laughing because something funny happened, laughter of any kind can often boost our mood. And it's not just good for our mental health. Our next guest joins us to talk about the health benefits of laughing and why she's trying to laugh more each day. And maybe you should, too. So we want to hear from you this half hour. What makes you laugh? Do you try to laugh every day? And do you find laughing improves your mood? Join us. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Dietlin is a keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. And Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, my goodness. So happy to be with you, Lee. And you know what? It's St. Patrick's Day. I think when all of us think about St. Patrick's Day, we all laugh and smile.
Absolutely. So, but how did you start down this personal voyage or investigation into laughter and what it means for you and everybody else?
You know, that is a great question. I think it first came to me when I was thinking about my mother's life. My mother is still alive, and she's in her early 80s, and she had a tough life. You know, many people have tough lives, and they become very bitter, and I have those people in my family. But when I thought about my mom, and as you know, I'm an author, I thought the title of the book would be My Mom's Story, A Life Lived in Courage and Laughter. And I started thinking about how often my family laughs. And that is one of our favorite things to do. And we are boisterous at Lee, and we are loud, and we laugh a lot.
Oh, you're those kind of laughers. I am too. So, but you found that first of all, this laughter thing that we do, it's not a language. It's not cultural. It's universal, or at least among humans, isn't it? Is there any humans that don't laugh?
No, that's what was shocking to me when I started doing some research is that, you know, when people go and travel, whether they're anthropologists, archaeologists, sociologists, anyologists, no matter what group they meet, they find that laughter is universal. And it's not just in humans, Lee. Primates siblings or sisters or close related relatives in the terms of the ape family, gorillas and chimpanzees, they actually laugh too. So it's a little bit more than beyond human beings. But when you think about all the places we travel and trying to fit in, you know, I love to travel internationally and I always try to prepare by studying a few phrases in a different language or understanding the customs. But I find if I have laughter in my toolbox, in my hip pocket, it goes a lot further in the conversation than, you know, getting frustrated that I didn't say the phrase right, or I didn't, you know, use the correct fork or whatever. I just love to laugh.
Well, and it can be a salve, certainly, but where does laughter fit in our human development? How does it evolve from childhood, from infancy? I mean,
Go ahead.
Do we laugh before we speak?
Yes, we sure do. How many of us don't look at little babies and love it when they smile at us or when they do that first giggle and they have those bubbles coming out of their mouth? And we just get so effervescent around babies when we want them to laugh and we want them to smile. And people who study babies find that babies usually start laughing. Are you ready for this, Lee?
Yeah.
At 3 months old. They start laughing at 3 months old.
Well, Lisa, they're not laughing at us. They're laughing with us.
Absolutely, they are. And, you know, it does so much for your mental health. I know we're going to talk about the physical part, you know, how it affects you physically. But in this day and age, when we talk and we're so worried about the mental health of so many people, especially our young people, our Gen Zers and Gen Yers, and it is such an endorphin release that you have this momentary high, and it helps. Studies have shown that it really helps your mental state. And I'm not talking about poking fun at somebody or laughing at somebody in distress. I mean, that's not the type of laughter we're talking about. We're talking about laughter that, you know, comes from the tips of your toes to the top of your head, and that really allows you to enjoy the moment that you're in, even if you're laughing at yourself.
Lisa Dietlin, our guest. I'm laughing with her right now, and we're inviting you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 with an important question about our health, mental and physical. What makes you laugh and why? Let's start with Lynn and Lyons this afternoon. Lynn, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I actually had a question. I don't laugh. Is it because I've heard every joke on the planet, or is there something wrong with me?
You don't laugh? Do you find things funny? And what's your response when you find something humorous?
I find it funny, but I don't respond.
Huh. That's interesting.
You know, I will jump in here, Lee. You know, recently, you know, last week, Lynn, is it? That's your name, right, Lynn?
Yep.
Okay, last week, Lynn, as you know, was International Women's Day, and Gloria Steinem was on many broadcasts and podcasts and interviews, and she said something that I had never heard before. She said, "Laughter is the only free emotion. It's the one that cannot be commanded, that you cannot be commanded to laugh." You know, you can't be like, I'm going to tell you this joke and you're going to laugh, or you're going to love this line in this movie or this sitcom. And she said, it's a way of, in her opinion, and whatever you think of Gloria Steinem, you know, it's in her opinion, the one emotion that we can control. You can be commanded to cry. You know, we see actors and actresses cry on cue, or she says, you know, we can be made to feel like we're in love, but you cannot be made to laugh. So I haven't dug deep enough to understand why you might not laugh. You might find it humorous, but you might not laugh. But if you take a page out of Gloria Steinem's book, she would say it's about a control issue, that it's you saying, I find it humorous, but I'm just not going to laugh.
Interesting. And Lynn, thank you so much for that perspective. Let's go now to Ginny in Platteville, who joins Lisa Dietlin. Ginny, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment. I volunteer one day.
Oh, you're cutting out a little bit here, Ginny. Give me a second, and we'll get back to you in a second once you get a better cell reception. We'll try again because I really want to hear from you. But
I do too.
I will ask you, Lisa, if there are ways, tools, or tips we can use to get more laughter out of our day, how can we find it without forcing it? Maybe it's a good question for Lynn as well.
Well, I think, yes, you can find it and you can incorporate it in your life. You know, some of the things that are recommended is have humorous things around you. I don't know about you, but I have bulletin boards in my office and whiteboards and pushpin boards. And I'm always, you know, I always put up sayings or things that bring a smile to my face. I have this one which shows this lady, you know, dressed in like her Sunday best, and there's a puddle, and it says, sometimes the best answer is what the heck, and she's going to jump the puddle. Every time I look at it, I do just like that. I just laugh like, yeah, you know, like what the heck, I'm going to try, you know, and the lady probably in the picture appears to be about 60 years old. And she's like, what the heck, I'm going to jump this puddle. And so one of the recommendations is, you know, to put humor on your horizon, have things in your house that make you laugh or make you smile. I love MASH. I have rediscovered MASH. You know, I don't think we watched it growing up. You know, I didn't have uncles that went and fought in the Vietnam War or aunts that were nurses, but I put on MASH when I want a good laugh, and the antics of Alan Alda and, you know, William Ogden Steers and all the other castmates, you know, just make me laugh from the tips of my toes to the top of my head. Their antics are just humble.
I appreciate that perspective. Let's see if we can get back to Ginny now with a better reception. Ginny, can you hear us?
Yeah, I went to my cell instead of my hands free.
Can you hear me better?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. I volunteer one day a week at a thrift store in town, and everybody who's there wants to be there, loves being there, and we laugh so much. And everyone who's there, the customers, the employees, everybody is so happy when they're there, and you leave there feeling good. And I think a big secret is to be around people who want to be where they are. Volunteering is a huge thing for me.
I love that. And while you might not get paid in currency, there is a certain currency to laughter, right, Lisa?
Yes,
absolutely. I agree with Jenny. You know, Jenny, when you were saying that, I was thinking I volunteer at our food bank, the Greater Chicago Food Depository here in Chicago. And the last time I volunteered to put boxes together, I always seem to get on the box duty, like physically putting the boxes together, you know, so there's paper cuts happening and you're wrestling these boxes, and they put on the best music, and I love music. And so I'm dancing and I'm singing and I'm making, and everyone is just cracking up laughing, you know, and before you know it, other people are being silly. And because we all want to be there, Jenny, like you said, at the thrift store, everybody wants to be there. Everyone has a smile, and it just takes one spark. You know, it takes one person saying, oh my gosh, let's all have a dance party, or oh my gosh, you know, isn't this fun? And I think in life, sometimes we get way too serious. My bookkeeper always says in my company about 2:30 in the afternoon, dance party. Exactly, Lee. Who doesn't love a dance party, you know?
Well, we're having a virtual dance party here on Central Time this afternoon with our guest, Lisa Dietlin, keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. And we're talking about the importance of laughter with you at 1-800-642-1234. More of your calls and the reasons why we laugh next on Central Time. Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk with Lisa Dietlin, the founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy, about why she finds joy in laughing and looks at it as a way to deal with some difficult things that happen in all of our lives. So what makes you laugh? Do you ever force a good laugh just to feel better? And how do you feel like laughing can change a social situation? 1-800-642-1234, where Dee in Bayfield standing by. Dee, good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon to you, and thank you for taking my call. What I like about those moments when we discover laughter is it takes me down a notch. The example I gave the operator is those moments when I think I have it all together. I think I'm on top of mindfulness, that I'm living in the here and now, and then I end up pushing on the pull door. or I try to get out of my car, and I still have my seatbelt on. And mm-hmm. And so it's those moments when I get a dose of reality. Nature is sort of tapping on my shoulder and saying, not yet. You're not perfect yet.
Yes, but it's also a sense of forgiveness and grace. That it's really that's really what it is, to me anyway, is it gives yourself a great degree of grace, and the ability to laugh at yourself, I would imagine, is a perfect salve for every time you feel your pride hurt a little bit.
It absolutely is. It's a balm for the soul. You know, It takes you out of your seriousness. Like, oh my gosh, I made such a mistake. You know, I appear on television, and I was in a chair getting ready, and it was a higher chair, and I dropped something on the floor, and I went to put my foot down. So I'm in like a high bar stool getting ready for the next segment. And they're on camera. The anchors are on camera. So I take my foot and I stretch it to grab that thing, you know, to roll it back toward me. And I fell out of the chair.
Oh.
I literally fell out of the chair. And I'm in this skirt. And I'm on the ground, and it goes boom in the studio. And thank gosh they were going to commercial. But the anchors came running over, and Rosemary came running over. And they're all like, are you okay? And I just laughed because the next time I came, they had a step stool for me.
They were prepared for Lisa Dietlin.
They were, and I wasn't, you know, I just thought, and my only thing was, I remember looking at the camera guy, like, is my necklace straight? Like, now I'm all disheveled. And I kid you not, to a person after that interview, people said, my gosh, your eyes were just sparking, like you were just on fire. And I thought, oh my God, if you only knew. And I told them, they go, Oh my gosh. So it is true. Whether you push the pull door or pull the push door or whatever you do, you got to have some humor at yourself, you know, and be willing to get back, you know, back in the saddle and try again. And, you know, part of it is we live in a world that so much is thrown at us, you know, Lee, that is negative. And my alma mater, Michigan State, had the shooting recently and going on in Turkey and Syria, let alone, you know, the shootings that happen every day all over the world and what's going on in the Ukraine. And I thought, how do I get through it? And I thought, laughter, you know, making time to laugh, because otherwise you drown in the sadness.
And you know, if, from the news perspective and dealing with news every day, and then sometimes filling in a live radio show, I inevitably virtually fall out of my chair all the time. So let's continue with the conversation with calls at 1-800-642-1234. Where, let me see here. Dennis in Two Rivers, good afternoon.
Hi, Lee. Sometimes we need to have a laugh because of all the serious things going on. Like, I know this is a month and a half late, but what bugs me are soil hoarders.
Soil hoarders? I am not familiar.
Well, they're celebrated on February 2nd. How? Why would we celebrate groundhogs?
Well, we love to laugh at Punxsutawney Phil, Dennis. We love to laugh at everyone in top hats. It's so silly.
You got a problem with groundhogs, Dennis?
Yeah, and he doesn't chuck wood worth a darn either.
Oh, Dennis, I think you called to make us laugh.
Thank you for that, Dennis. We need that. Let's go to Steve, who's driving through. Steve, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, this is Steve. listen, I'm a musician, and I play at nursing homes, and that includes memory care, assisted living, and independent living. In fact, I'm driving right now back from a gig at a nursing home, and I'll tell you, I play music. I try to choose music that's going to make them smile, going to make them laugh. This afternoon, I played some music that just got people up laughing and dancing and carrying on. It was a treat just getting people out of, you know, the isolation of living under those conditions and that sort of thing. And, it was just memorable.
Yeah, so. Memorable for them, but it sounds like you got as much out of it as anybody else, Steve.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct.
So,
and you know,
yeah, Lisa,
Steve, what I'm thinking about is during COVID, how we found things like that when we were locked in, and whether you believe we should have been shut in or not, what was beautiful is how creative we all got, you know, and how many videos we'd watch or things on Facebook or Instagram or whatever of people being really creative and just to laugh because it just seems so serious around us. And you're absolutely right. When you're isolated, you need a good belly laugh and a good reason to smile.
We've got our Central Time producer, Emily Burdett, told us how she resets after a day of reading some tough news stories, which has been part of her job for the last year. And it's her last day today, so it's a little bittersweet for all of us. But she sounded off on what makes her laugh.
Something that seems to always be able to lighten my mood is just going to the dog park with my dog or going out for a walk in nature and just sort of, especially if I've been reading a lot of sad news stories or I feel like there's just a lot of bad things going on in the world at that time, just kind of putting my phone away, leaving my phone at the house and going outdoors and hanging out with my dog and seeing other people's dogs.
Lisa Dietlin, can you explain to us why it is that our domestic animals bring us so much never-ending joy?
I don't understand it because I'm not an animal lover. No, I do. I obviously do. I have friends that do it. And I grew up with animals, and many of my siblings have cats and dogs. And they bring that comfort. They bring that emotional support. And they're silly, you know. They do silly things. They have silly grins on their face, or, you know, they chase their own tail or their, you know, paw in the sunlight. And they just bring us that comfort that we so need in our lives. And I'm so sad to see Emily go. I'm glad for the adventure ahead of her, but I am glad that she has realized that when you deal in a tough business, as you folks do, with the difficult news that comes every single day, to your doorstep that you have to report on, that finding those outlets, finding those moments that bring humor to your life or a smile, you know, it's the small things, even if you don't have a belly laugh, you know, and I know some of us are dealing with really serious issues. Even if you don't have that belly laugh, find something to smile about. And if it's throwing a stick for your dog to retrieve, or catnip for your cat, or, you know, walking outside, or knowing a good knock-knock joke, watching an old sitcom that brings a smile to your face. There's nothing like, you know, a deputy Barney Fife on Andy Griffith, you know, that slapstick Jerry Lewis or Dean Martin, whatever it is that brings a smile to your face, that lightens your mood a little bit. It does help you physically, your internal organs, you know, reap the benefit of it. Your blood pressure goes down. They actually say that there was a study done. I can't believe all the studies that are done on laughter, Lee, but there was a study done saying that if somehow people would have heart attacks, and then they're in a restaurant and something happens, water gets spilled on them, wine, the people that laugh have like this 80% less likelihood of having a second heart attack if you laugh at the fact that water was spilt on you or wine spilt or something happened than if you got really angry. And I thought, boy, that's a really special area of research, but I'm all laugh when something bad. And I've seen, you know, we've all seen that where a plate of spaghetti falls off the plate, or, you know, I had a friend and in a pub we were in, and a board member was trying to be funny, and he had the tray over his head and brought it down, and every drink fell on her head. Ooh. I mean, like, she was drenched, and he was horrified, and she laughed.
It's about you how know? You react to it, and what that reaction means about not just your mental health, but your physical well-being. Lisa Dietlin, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for yours this afternoon and for the good laughs.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to all of our callers, too. Keep laughing.
Lisa Dietlin, keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy, joining us today to talk about why she started laughing more and the importance of experiencing laughter. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, it's Food Friday. And we're taking a trip to Puerto Rico to learn more about the island's culture, history, and cooking. But first, Cyclone Freddy, which just dissipated after raging for 34 days, has broken multiple records. Cyclone Freddy's the longest-lasting tropical cyclone ever observed, the most energetic tropical cyclone on record, and there's more. So far, there have been over 300 deaths and tens of thousands of people displaced in Malawi and Mozambique, the countries most affected by this storm. And we're talking about climate change and extreme weather events in the wake of this record-breaking Cyclone Freddy. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the nexus of climate change and our extreme weather events? Do you worry about natural disasters like these and climate change? Join us. 1-800-642-1234, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Joining us to start off our discussion is Derek Herndon. He's an assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, where he studies hurricane intensity. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Yeah, thank you for having me, and good job getting that out. That's a mouthful.
It is, but you've got a lot going on there. And so from your perspective, give us some idea of just how broad, big, and menacing this Cyclone Freddy was.
Well, I, as you mentioned on the, you know, the intro there, it's really the thing we're going to remember this storm for is its longevity. You know, 34 days is a long time for a cyclone to exist. So typically, these storms only exist for 5, maybe 10 days. We occasionally see storms go for 2 weeks, but to go for more than 30 days really is pretty spectacular. So it's very unusual in that regard. It was also a fairly strong storm, so it reached a Category 5 intensity, what we would consider on the Saffir-Simpson scale in the Atlantic. So really at the top end of the scale in terms of intensity. It didn't make landfall at that intensity. It was a weaker storm. But the long storm track and the slow motion over land really are going to be the features we'll probably remember about this storm.
Yeah. What do you have to compare it to in terms of tropical storms? Although this is historic, have we seen anything else like this in terms of duration, strength, and for that matter, Derek, the number of times it intensified?
Right. So in terms of comparing it to a storm that lasted a similar amount of time, the last storm was Hurricane John in 1994. That storm formed in the eastern Pacific off the coast of Mexico, passed near Hawaii, and actually ended up almost to the Aleutian Islands. That storm actually started as a disturbance all the way back in Africa that we can track. But when we look at the tracks of these storms, we kind of start tracking them once they become what we call a tropical cyclone, so sustained winds of at least of about 30 miles per hour or stronger. So 1994 would be the closest analog, and this storm beat that storm by a couple of days.
And tell me a little bit about how this storm was, it set a record for the number of times it intensified, 7 times. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, that also is curious. Partly, I think, it's just the length of the storm, how long it lasted, gave it opportunities to change intensity a couple of times. The storm actually struggled a fair amount as it was tracking from the east towards the west in the southern Indian Ocean. It was battling some bouts of dry air that kind of pulled into the storm, and some upper-level winds were kind of trying to weaken it. So those factors weakened the storm a little bit, but every time it bounced back, and whenever it bounced back, it actually bounced back fairly fast. So that's where we get that rapid intensity. So we're talking a change of intensity of about 35, 40 miles per hour in about 24 hours or so. And yeah, it did that 7 times. Very unusual, and we've not seen a storm do that. Again, partly because the storm spent so much time over very, very warm water.
Derek Herndon, our guest, assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Study, Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And so what do we know about the conditions that kept this storm going for so long, the conditions that made it so intense, and the conditions that reinvigorated it so many times, Derek?
So the conditions that kept it so intense were really tied to the fact that the storm really wasn't gaining any latitude. It wasn't moving towards the polar regions like many storms do. There was actually a storm out ahead of the storm, Dingane, which did recurve into the poles and did not last very long. But in the wake of that storm, the subtropical ridge kind of built in and kind of trapped Freddy from gaining any latitude, and basically moved almost due east to due west. And the area that it moved over is very, very warm. So the water was plenty warm enough to support the intensity and these intensity changes. So that the primary thing that kept it going really was those warm waters. And those waters are based on, you know, changes over many decades, 30 years, we can look at the averages are warmer than average.
Well, in 30 years is where you take us back to about the last analogous tropical storm event when you mentioned Hurricane John in 1994. Is this something we'd expect in another 30 years, or might we see something like Cyclone Freddy sooner than that again, do you suspect?
I highly doubt we'll see anything like it soon, because the conditions that produced this long track really just all kind of cut. Basically, all the things had to come together at exactly the right time. And to have that happen is, it's fairly rare, as we've seen. But there is some indication that storms might be slowing down. And that's because the Arctic is warming at a faster rate than the rest of the planet is. What that does is it changes the temperature gradient from north to south and makes it weaker. Well, the weaker temperature gradient also means that the wind flow, the jet stream, is also weaker. So that's what's pushing these storms. And with weaker wind flow, these storms will spend more time over water and in some cases spend more time over land. That was really the problem with this storm, is that once it did move into Madagascar, it stalled. And we're starting to see that is becoming more common, that these storms are moving slower. And because they're moving slower, they're producing more rainfall.
So what do your fellow researchers, how do you look and talk about Cyclone Freddy? How do you put this in some context of the work that you do every day, Derek?
The work that we do every day really is about trying to understand these intensity changes, trying to observe them from satellites, because keep in mind that as Freddy's moving across the Indian Ocean, there are no observations there. There are very few islands, and all the ships are getting out of the way, and there aren't really many buoys there either. So the only way that we can observe these storms is from satellite data. So that's what I do on the day-to-day. I am analyzing satellite data to estimate how strong the storm is, the storm's position, which way it's moving, and also the environment that the storm exists in. So we're using this satellite data to analyze, is there any dry air in the environment, and what is the steering flow look like for this storm? And I should note, you know, that some of our satellites are starting to age, so we're trying to replace those. And we have some new satellite launches going up later this year to help with that.
When I follow the track of Cyclone Freddy, it seemed to bounce for a while between the island of Madagascar and the southeastern coast of Africa. What was going on there? Was it going back and forth like that?
It really was going back and forth like that. It crossed Madagascar and moved, or crossed Madagascar, moved into Mozambique. It stalled, and then the wind flow basically changed and pushed it back out over the channel, where it found warmer water again, re-intensified, approached Madagascar again, stalled, and then turned again and moved back towards Mozambique. So what's happening there is that the flow is transient and changing, and is also fairly weak. And that's really what promotes these slow stalling storms.
The way you speak of it, it makes me think of a living thing. Like this storm is actually feeding, and it is, you know, expending energy. It is stalling out, resting, but then it's getting back on its feet again and recharging and going back out there.
Sure. As long as the storm is over water, there's potential for it to intensify. Once the storm moves over land, it loses its heat source and will eventually spin down. Unfortunately, in this case, it did so very slowly and did not move very much.
But with the jet stream slowing, being weaker, and you mentioned the storm slowing down, is this something we might see again sooner rather than later?
Absolutely. There was another storm back in 2019, Cyclone Idai, that did a very similar track to what Freddie did, at least in that area around Mozambique and Madagascar. And that storm was devastating, over 1,500 deaths. Again, most of those deaths are from flooding, freshwater flooding.
Hey, Derek, I appreciate you starting this conversation with us this afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Derek Herndon, assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Studies, Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, joining us today to look at climate change, extreme weather events, and the record-breaking Cyclone Freddy that killed hundreds. We invite you to join the conversation because we're going to continue now with a more global look at not just the cyclone itself, but the global climate. And you can join us with your questions or comments about what you see, what you fear at 800-642-1234, or your hopes for what we may learn about our global climate change and our role in it. 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. Conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation about Cyclone Freddy, which has devastated Malawi and Mozambique, two countries in southeastern Africa that already struggle with high poverty rates and food insecurity. Research has shown that poor countries are impacted disproportionately by climate change. Although they contribute the least to greenhouse gas emissions, poor countries are more vulnerable to the effects of climate change, including more extreme weather events like Cyclone Freddy. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're taking a look at how climate change affects impoverished populations now. And our guest, next guest, is Laurie DePreet Brown, Director for Global Health and Human Ecology and Distinguished Teaching Faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She's also a co-director, along with Zikani Kwanda, on the Malawi Circle of Care Project. And Laurie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And we also have Dr. Zikani Kwanda joining us. He's the director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, a Malawian non-governmental organization that works with UW-Madison. Dr. Zikani, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Hey, doctor, where are you this afternoon?
Right in Zomba, southern part of Malawi, near where we are experiencing the cyclone devastation impact currently. That's where we are.
And tell me, yes, please tell me what you see, Dr. Kwanda.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is that something which has happened, which has never happened. Some people from their historical perspective, they say they've never seen such a devastating thing for more than 40 years. It's quite new, and it has affected most parts of the rural areas. And then we also have got some challenges with the same impact in the city, Blantyre, which usually has never faced such calamities. Usually it has been in the rural areas. Go
ahead.
Yes. Currently we're seeing a lot of people around trying to support wherever they can. And we are also, you know, trying to find out how many people actually have, you know, I mean, they have, you know, been affected by this cyclone. So what has happened is that what we're seeing is that, first of all, the attention was paid towards the city, because that's where, you know, many people are. And it was something very strange to see such thing happening. But most of it happened because we had flash floods coming from the mountains. People are saying that this is because the mountain, which previously was preserved for catchment, being a catchment area for water source, but somehow, as the population has been growing, most of those trees were cut down, and people started building in those mountains. What we can see and what we remember is that the other people, the city people, tried to get an injunction that people should not build in those areas, but they continued building those areas. 5 years ago, this was said that this is not an area to reside or to construct things. But now, 5 years down the road, we have this calamity where more than 352 people have died. And plus in the rural areas, we are having the numbers are quite high. I think we are yet to get numbers from the rural setting. What we can see also is that the first attention was given to the cities, as I said, but right now it's when it's going, the rescue operations are going out into the rural areas. These are very poor people. If you had a chance, you'd see that in the rivers, the people, some of them are stuck. They're just there. For 3 days, they could not, be rescued. We didn't have any helicopters. We didn't have any speedboats that could go and dig these people. And they just, were in their trees. Some of them, because of being tired and hungry, they could fall into the water and off. And we have lost such people. So it's a very disastrous. And then they are using some canoes, which they have some, but it's nothing really if you compare to the rescue operations that happen in other countries. It's going to be very tough for these people to come back to their lives, in the sense that most of the houses where these floods have happened, they are submerged, some have collapsed. And the crops, which were about to be, quite ready for eating and harvesting, it's all gone. And it's they have literally nothing right now. So to cope up with such things, what we're seeing is that the religious people are coming in, trying to comfort them. Some of them are putting together some resources to help them. They have also put some camps where they are sitting and where they're staying. But really, it's very hard. And, some of the things which we're seeing here is quite devastating. We see just maybe a child of about 9 years old, the father, the mother, the brothers all gone and just alone. I don't know. It's just traumatic.
I am so very sorry to hear it, but I want to thank you for sharing what's happening in Malawi. That's Dr. Zikani Kaunda, who is the director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, which is a Malawian non-government organization that works with the UW-Madison with what's happening in the aftermath of Cyclone Freddy. Also joining us, Lori DePreet Brown, Director for Global Health and Human Ecology and a distinguished teaching faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Lori, let me turn to you for a second, just to get some reaction on what Zikani Kaunda is seeing in Malawi today and how he describes the flash flooding that came from the mountains after the clear cutting of trees, what comes after when the crops have all been washed away in a subsistence farming area. How do you describe what is happening in the aftermath of Cyclone Freddy?
Well, I think, when we think about, what this is, it's really a complex emergency. And this happens to be a cyclone. We can think about earthquakes. We can think about disease outbreaks. And whenever those things happen, besides analyzing causes and understanding causes, which is very important for prevention, I think it's a moment of response. And what what we see again and again in these situations is food systems, energy systems, all communications broken down, housing, which is very, you know, the most vulnerable folks are people whose you know, roofs are already were incomplete. And so the housing structures come into it, and then people's livelihoods of all kinds are disrupted. The other thing is the kind of PTSD or the emotional trauma, if you will, not just of the community, but of the workforce that has to continually respond. And, you know, in our situation, sometimes those folks are people who've experienced some of the other complex emergencies in Malawi. And it really is this kind of this again moment, even though we're describing it as very rare, having to respond to crisis that is systemic and that it's so long term. The long shadow of this is so much more than what the news cycle will be. And we struggle. Dr. Sukani has mentioned the struggle with, you know, differential responses to the city and the rural area can be more isolated. They don't even know what's going on. I think the other thing we can look at is the global responses and how we might respond differently and maybe, you know, maybe less, to be honest, when it is an African situation where people seem very different from us, because these folks are extremely resilient. You know, think of your grandfather on the farm, you know, fighting to get all the pigs inside during a storm or whatever. That's the kind of grit that people are talking about. And they are relying on their faith and each other and those kind of community systems to get through. But I hope we'll keep paying attention for the long haul to really have true and meaningful development, as well as all the prevention that needs to happen.
So this has disrupted all aspects of life, and I can't even fathom that, you know, your food sources are gone, your communication's down, your housing is gone, your livelihoods are disrupted. And Lori, just to reiterate here, you said maybe while we should pay attention to it, that we should step back from it a little bit?
No, I'm saying we should keep paying attention.
Yes.
The crisis moment is only one part of a complex emergency. The cholera, you know, the risks, the housing, the issue of livelihoods and what people have to resort to earn a living when other livelihoods are you know, this is a 2 or 3 year engagement with communities, not just today. Yes. And it's just so hard, you know, to extend the news cycle. But keep paying attention to these, to the holistic impacts.
And let us turn our attention back to Dr. Zakani here, who is in Malawi for us this afternoon. Freddie is just one disaster, doctor, but there are long-term effects. What kind of long-term support do Malawi and other countries need when it comes to recovering from the disaster that they're facing right now?
Yeah, so I think what we're looking here, the challenge is that right now we're looking at the immediate, you know, support that they should. They should be given. That's that they should come back to their lives. But I think the long term, we you know, when you look at the long term, it's how will these establish themselves in this society? So they're of different ages, as I've mentioned. So you talk about the young ones who have lost their parents. All along they were depending upon those parents. So in such a case, it needs long term support in terms of whether it's financial, for them to attend their education or for them to find their livelihood. And those could be long term for those type of people. But when you talk about the elderly ones, so probably what we're looking at, like in these other areas where we are right now, is that, you know, so all the crops are gone, mm-hmm. and the land is also maybe just having some rocks everywhere, because it you know, you cannot maybe grow such crops. So you've got to start thinking of whether they should be relocated or to a place where they can. If they were, like in the rural areas, these were farmers.
Yes.
They cannot completely change to something else. If you,
Doctor, I apologize. We are out of time, and we've got news right ahead. That's Dr. Zakani Kaunda, Director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, joining us live from Malawi today, along with Lori DePreet Brown, Director for Global Health and Human Ecology, and a distinguished teaching faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison.